Welcome to our Perimenopause What the F podcast, brought to you by the Peri community. In this podcast, your host, Rachel Hughes, talks everything, and we mean everything, perimenopause. She helps us navigate through all our what the F perimenopause moments and all, is this normal, questions. Rachel talks with perimenopause experts, thought leaders, and inspirational voices of the community. To connect with other perimenopause warriors, download our free Peri app. You can find the link in our show notes. And now, let's dive right in.
Hey everyone, this is Rachel of Rachel Hughes Midlife here with another episode of Peri Talks, where we like to deep dive into all things perimenopause and menopause, bringing you the science and the sisterhood. Welcome everyone to the episode. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Suzanne Gilbert-Lenz, known around Los Angeles for her menopause boot camp retreats. Dr. Suzanne offers that menopause is a whole life condition that warrants a broad approach, one that combines yoga, herbs, meditation, and therapy with current medical solutions and science. She really is a doctor after my own heart. I am so happy to welcome Dr. Suzanne to the Peri community. For future episodes, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. And now, let's get started. Hello and welcome.
Hi.
Let me introduce you. A diplomat of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Dr. Gilbert-Lenz received her medical degree from USC School of Medicine and completed her residency in obstetrics and gynecology at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. She completed her clinical Ayurvedic specialist degree at California College of Ayurveda, and is board certified in integrative and holistic medicine. Dr. Gilbert-Lenz is involved in women's empowerment and public education and frequently appears as an expert in women's health and integrative medicine on TV. Lots of TV lately. Very exciting. In print and online. Dr. Gilbert-Lenz is also medical advisor at Kindra, the menopause supplement brand, and is author of the recently published Menopause Bootcamp, Optimize Your Health, Empower Yourself, and Flourish as You Age. Please get this book if you have not read it yet. Her popular menopause bootcamp events help guide people through the transition of menopause. As Dr. Gilbert-Lenz believes that the 27 million women entering menopause every year deserve modern, holistic, honest, thoughtful, and considerate information regarding their health, both in mind and body. So, Dr. Suzanne, welcome to the Peri community. I just want to ask if anyone is not muted that they.
I think they probably don't realize they're not muted.
I think so. I think it might be. Is it Jessica? I can't see. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So yeah, just mute yourself if you haven't yet. So you go to medical school, you complete your residency, and then you decide that you're also interested in other kinds of medicine, ancient medicine, and you become an Ayurvedic specialist, which really expanded and informed your practice of medicine and allowed you to go deeper into the study of health and healing. Could you expand a bit more on that here?
Well, I mean, I think it basically, I always was very interested in other people's experiences and in story. And I think that helped me in medicine tremendously, because I was naturally curious and naturally a listener. And even in medical school, I was always very interested in what were the cultural beliefs and systems that people brought to their experiences. I was, you know, at LA County Hospital, so we had and have a very large indigenous population that has either indigenous to this area or indigenous to Central America and Mexico, and was interacting a lot with those people. And I am also an LA native, so that was not new for me. I also traveled quite a bit as a small child and throughout my life, and I think all of these things came to bear. So I was not a foreigner to different kinds of thinking, right?
Yeah.
I also come from a very strong cultural background. I'm Jewish and very identified in my community. So I understood what it was like to be different and to be other. So mm-hmm. I think those are the things that kind of informed me. And then when I was in medical school and in residency, interacting with patients and understanding what they were bringing to their experience, I felt really drawn to it. And, you know, when you're in your training, you don't have a lot of time to dig into a lot of other things because you're really like in survival mode big time. Mm-hmm. But I had a very profound experience with one particular patient. I write about it in the book, but I met a patient who herself was very involved in holistic healing practices. She came to us as in the resident clinic for a medical issue that wasn't being resolved in a non-conventional way, kind of like in resignation, but with respect. And we did surgery on her, and I watched her healing process post-operatively and how different it was because of the other community aspects and sort of more traditional methods that were being used by her and by her community. And she had a really remarkable post-operative experience, and it was really, really interesting to me. And she came to me later and offered to introduce me basically into that world, and she did. And so she introduced me to Ayurveda. I mean, it's a much more involved story than that, but that she was my entree into that world. And initially I started studying it, Rachel, because I was just curious, not really seeing it for anything other than what it was. I always liked to learn. But I also think I was really attracted to it because I realized from very early in my practice, even as a medical student, that something else was going on. Like, obviously my skill set was really important. I'm a surgeon, okay? Like, that's real stuff. But there was something else that was going on between the patient and the healer, especially people who consider themselves a healer. I am a doctor, but I also consider myself a healer. And I think that probably motivated me the most. And then when I studied Ayurveda, it all kind of came together. And I realized, like, whoa, first of all, this is a system of healing that preceded ours by thousands and thousands of years. Yeah. And they were actually right about many things, including neurovascular anatomy, you know, like when Westerners in particular look down upon integrative medicine or a traditional holistic medicine, they are not aware often of how racist they are being.
Yeah.
And it's really an expression of colonialism. Mm-hmm. And I think I feel very confident in saying that.
I highlighted that in your book. I was so glad to read it, and it really you're emphatic me. About it. Yeah.
It bothers me. And I think we're in a moment of self-examination, I think, in a good way, in you know, conventional medicine, Western medicine, whatever you want to call it. But there's a real blind spot, because I think a lot of the people who are white people who are involved in like wanting to, you know, center other voices, and I think they really are well-intentioned. There's that one blind spot around that. And it's like, if you don't see that the attitude, and I'm being nice about it, toward indigenous medicine is racist, you have a lot more work to do.
Right.
Period, end of sentence. Right. That's it.
Yeah.
It's arrogant and bizarre to me to think that we nailed it in the last 50 years. We do a lot of things right. Nobody can do everything. And science is not a religion. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people make it that. But science evolves. Science changes.
It certainly does. And I think just to continue to thread the needle, one thing that I find so fascinating is this sort of revisiting in a way that's actually like just I'm discovering, but it really isn't. It's sort of revisiting very old medicine and practices, behaviors, focus on whole body, whole mind health that's actually really old and has little to do with Western medicine.
Yeah, like it's funny to me, like you think you invented that? Nobody invented anything at this point. Right. Like nothing is new, okay? Nothing is new. And that's okay, but I think we should be more honest about that. And that requires a really deep level of self-inquiry, honestly, mm-hmm. and integrity. And And I do think, before it seems like we're going so far afield, I think one of the great gifts of midlife and the menopausal transition is sort of that return to what is true. That return to, for me, there's been a lot of like a return to the wisdom of myself, return to the wisdom of my ancestors, recognition of what your ancestors and my ancestors had in common, coming together, reestablishment of community, because, you know, like I am a doctor in this life and in this body and in this time. And again, I'm so grateful for the knowledge and the skills I have and the entree that I have, you know, I mean, honestly, to be really honest, like a lot of what I'm telling you, I learned because I had the privilege of getting an MD, but a lot of what I'm telling you, you're only listening to me because I have an MD, and that's okay. I'm fine with that. Like I'm on the Drew Barrymore show because I have an MD behind my name. Okay. Let's be honest. That's okay. That's what I think. And that's okay. That's okay. You want to listen to me because of that? Okay, cool.
Well, I'd want to listen
to say.
Yeah, I'd want to listen to you without all that. But I hear what you're saying. I do. I get it.
In our culture, like the credentials are really important. And I'm not saying credentials are not important for anything.
Sure.
But like, I get it. I know how to play the game. I'm Gen X.
Right.
I got the memo.
Right. Well, listen, as I was thinking about this conversation and having read your book, I thought, how can I best extract sort of this whole approach that you have, that you offer to patients in your practice and outside of it here? And I thought if I were coming to see you as a patient and I brought with me my sort of top 10 list of menopausal symptoms, and I asked you to speak both to the Ayurvedic approach and the conventional medicine approach, what might you say about each of those things? And then now, of course, every individual is different, right, and enters into your office with a host of their own particular challenges and symptoms. But just to sort of be broader strokes here, because we're speaking to a lot of people, I wonder if you could just start by sort of giving us a brief explanation of Ayurvedic medicine. And yes, then if we could get into some of those specific menopausal symptoms as we know them, and then allow you time and space to answer those things in both of those ways, if that makes sense.
It does, but I'm gonna preempt that by telling you that I'm not going to do that because it isn't what I do.
Okay.
And that's really important. And that's a really important piece of information for people to understand about me. I'm trained Ayurvedically. I do not practice Ayurveda in any classical way. Ayurveda, and now I'll tell you what Ayurveda is.
Yeah.
So Ayurveda is the indigenous medicine of the subcontinent that we call India, right? So it grew up around the same time as Chinese medicine. I think people are more familiar in this country with acupuncture and Chinese medicine. And they have a lot of similarities of how they look at how energy flows through the body, and a paradigm that is very different, a more holistic understanding that everything influences everything. In terms of Ayurveda, we talk about what are called the doshas, which are sort of very specific elements that each of us is made of. So each of us is made of the five elements: ether, air, water, earth, and fire, in different combinations, and they are unique to us. And we have a unique doshic constitution, which guides who we are. But the idea in Ayurveda is that really ultimately all disease is a result of our misapprehension, our misunderstanding of ourselves as not spiritual beings. In other words, when we do not understand that we are spiritual beings, this is where disease starts. Having said that, they're very, very specific about very specific parts of our bodies. There's a whole different anatomy and how to approach it, and the disease or the imbalance, where at which point is it occurring? Can it be rebalanced by lifestyle, by herbs, by sleep, by diet, by season, by locality? Again, individualized. So this is one of the reasons that people get very confused with this stuff, right? but also about the time in your life and where you are and who you are. So it's really, you can't allopathize something or, you know, that is not allopathic. So that's one of the biggest issues. And I think this is a big issue in the sort of the wellness world, where Westerners, Americans in particular, really want to like take something romantic about ancient indigenous medicine and like package it in a way that is more familiar to us, which I do understand and appreciate, but that's not how that works.
Not how it works. Okay.
It's not how that works. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two, like most indigenous cultures, a lot of women's health is not recorded on paper. And right. Ayurveda has textbooks that are 3,000 years old and amazing. Like, talk about surgery, because they're also not like, oh, you woo it out. You do this, you do that. You know what? Guess what? There are surgical texts like, hey, you may have to cut this thing off and this is how to do it. It's wild. Like, there are textbooks on surgery from 2,500 years ago, which is amazing to me. Mm-hmm. So very, very practical, by the way. But there, most of the what's codified on paper or in the books is about sort of how to produce a royal heir. I mean, the patriarchy isn't new. Mm-hmm. So a lot of women's medicine is really sort of word of mouth and like women's circles and things like that. And you find that in a lot of indigenous culture in general. So there isn't necessarily, I mean, that's not to say that there aren't herbs that might be helpful or knowledge in like really deeply rooted Ayurvedic communities or practices. But that's not what I do. It infuses my worldview. It infuses how I look at a person. I look at somebody, mind, body, spirit. I'm very, very interested in healthy lifestyle, which includes not just what you're eating and how you're exercising, but like what you're consuming in terms of the people around you and media and stuff like that, who you're surrounding yourself with. So I don't address things necessarily that way. There are certain classic Ayurvedic herbs I love, but they're not for everybody. And I'm very, very respectful of that, tradition. I don't like to sort of disrupt
it. I get it. That's so helpful. Yeah. It's sort of like it's the umbrella over all else that you do and the kind of how you receive and then understand and then support someone coming into your office.
Yeah. And I do use a lot of botanical medicine because it's interesting the way I was trained in the United States, and my teacher felt very strongly that we should understand Ayurvedic herbs, but that we also should practice Ayurveda in a lot of ways, which meant, well, our seasonal local herbs are Western herbs. So I actually was taught with an Ayurvedic approach to what's available here in the West. So a lot of times that, so I actually use Western herbs more because that's what's available here. And that's like part of Ayurveda. And there's a lot of interesting data on some of those herbs. And I tend to lean on those a lot for a lot of people's symptoms.
Okay. So let's start to go through this stuff anyway, because you will help us in this. And these are sort of like the heavy hitters, if you will.
Right.
That being said, I have some community member questions as well, and people may throw some things in the chat. And then I would like, hopefully, if time allows, to get through sort of the mind part also. So I'll try and sort of, manage our time well. Okay. Hot flashes.
Yes. Okay. So you want me to just like talk about hot flash, like how to treat them or
yes,
what they are?
That would be delightful. Yes.
Okay. So here's the reality. I don't want anybody to have the misperception that like, I don't use medication, but hormone therapy, estrogen is the most effective tool that you have in the toolkit to fight vasomotor symptoms, to fight hot flashes, night sweats, all of that. Now, that's not going to be for everybody for a variety of reasons. Hopefully everybody has already read the New York Times wonderful article from 2.5 weeks ago. I feel like I need to print it and like put it on my desk because I've been saying this for 20 years. But if you have some unholy fear about hormone therapy and think it's going to kill you and your mom and like you actually very well might be wrong. So I really would love for you to read that. Having said that, it's not for everybody, and you know, we use what we can. So hormones, estrogen specifically, excellent. Now, the other thing you need to understand is that there's never going to be the same kind of robust data on botanicals compared to medicines that are pharma for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. But I think that black cohosh, I think French marine pine bark, I think actually quite a bit of this. So I isoflavones, red clover. Specifically, I really like Russian or Siberian rhubarb. These can all be very effective for hot flashes, especially when people are kind of early, like in early perimenopause when things are starting to shift and like maybe you have a pretty regular cycle and you're noticing you're hot flashing a lot at night, you know, the week before your period. I find those can be really, really, really helpful. So those are some of my top things for hot flashes, but also exercise has been shown to decrease hot flashing. Good sleep, which of course can get disrupted by having hot flashes, can help.
Yeah.
Having some kind of a relaxation, meditation, you know, whatever you want to do in that way can be very helpful. And I think people need to know that when they're having a lot of hot flashes, if they're associated with heart palpitations and things like that, don't be worried. But we do know that people with more severe hot flashes and certain features, it's actually a little bit of an early warning sign for heart disease. So take it seriously and make sure you're talking to a knowledgeable physician so that you're looking at other, you know, other things that might be going on with your health.
How about what we're consuming? Food, caffeine, sure. Alcohol, all that
people
stuff
get,
matters.
People get triggered all the time. So alcohol is a really big one. Mm. Alcohol is a big one. Spicy food, caffeine, you kind of hit those. Those are the big ones. So for some people, a lot of sugar. I don't hear it quite as much. I mean, sugar is a problem for other reasons. But yeah. I think alcohol at night is like, listen, who doesn't want a glass of wine or a cocktail occasionally at night? I do it too. But the truth is it is kind of bad. It's really bad for everything. It really yeah. is. It messes your sleep up. It messes your hormones up. It messes your blood sugar up. It's just not.
It's not doing it for you. So you mentioned sleep a couple of times. Could you go on a bit about sleep disruptions and what might be helpful there?
Sleep disruption is probably the hardest problem that I face. Like I still haven't found the holy grail, you know? I think, and what I normally hear from people is it's not falling asleep, it's staying asleep, which is just so hard. So a couple of things, really practicing sleep hygiene. I think all of us know what that is at this point, and most of us do not do it. And that is really serious, putting those screens away, you know, at least an hour, if not more, before bedtime. And that's TV, the whole thing. Keeping the room cool, which is going to be better for hot flashes also, or getting like a chill pad. Those are going to be kind of expensive, but there are these things that you can have under your mattress that cool okay. you off. There's also cooling pillows. So that's probably more affordable for most people. Those are all ways to help people keep asleep. Stopping eating several hours before bedtime, because your body is busy metabolizing in those couple hours after that last meal. And so there can be some benefit to people in terms of not having any big fluctuations in their blood sugar that might wake them. Like we mentioned, alcohol and avoiding caffeine really past noon, making sure you're exercising. And I think most people are going to do better to exercise earlier in the day. A lot of times when people exercise at the end of the day, it kind of ramps them up.
Right.
But the other thing is, you know, and this is where hormone therapy can be helpful. Melatonin, it's kind of controversial. I think taking melatonin as a vitamin, not like, I think the problem when people try to take herbs, Rachel, like they would a pharma, it doesn't work. That's not mm-hmm. how it works. Mm-hmm. So like melatonin declines in our own body as we age, which is why all of us have trouble sleeping. Same with vasopressin, which literally keeps you asleep so you don't keep having to get up to pee.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no vasopressin. I learned that in your book. I didn't know that at all.
There's no vasopressin replacement therapy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Melatonin, I think taking probably a small dose of melatonin all the time, every night, is better than like trying to take it occasionally. Again, that data is not that clear. So these are all things that could be helpful. But if you wake up also, like, don't engage, you know, like put a meditation tape on, or, you know, put an app on that's a white noise and try to just sleep. Like, try not to get up and start doing stuff, because you're just going to wake yourself up and now you're going to be screwed up.
Interesting.
It's hard.
Okay. It is really hard. Yeah, I never had sleep problems until I got sort of late into perimenopause, where I'm hovering now. And I found progesterone to be.
Well, I was just going to bring that up. Progesterone's amazing. Progesterone will 100% help you fall asleep. I still have a lot of people though who they still wake up. Mm. And sometimes what will happen with the progesterone is that it will work really well for the first couple of months, and then you kind of start getting used to it. But that's sure. low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. I will say that, look, it's difficult, because we know that not sleeping on a regular basis is really harmful to everything from our brain health to our mood to our metabolic health. And so again, I really don't want to scare people, but you know, using a lot of the over-the-counter sleep remedies, actually, it's really not a good idea to do that on the regular. There's plenty of data demonstrating that it actually is not good for your brain. Mm. So, like, you know, just because you can get it without a prescription doesn't mean that it might not be harmful in some ways. Occasionally, it's fine. But, you know.
But try not to go there.
Yeah.
Okay. GSM.
Genital urinary syndrome of menopause. So, that is the overarching term that we now use to discuss the changes that happen to not only the vulva and the vagina and to our sexual health, but also to the urinary tract, because all of those tissues are fed by estrogen. And so as estrogen declines, we start seeing changes in the tissue. The tissue itself gets thinner. It's more delicate. It's not as responsive. We have less elastin, less collagen, so it's not stretchy. It's more friable, more delicate, more easily to not tolerate friction, to break. The microbiome changes, the pH shifts. So it sounds so terrible, right?
It's a lot.
Right, it is. But I mean, a lot of times people, I think more about vaginal dryness, and they don't realize that they're chronic, you know, urinary tract infections are related to that too. And that a lot of people, they think they're having a bladder infection. It's really not a bladder infection. It's just the tissue's dry and irritated. Mm. So again, estrogen is really miraculous here. And other forms of, there's also something called prasterone, which is DHEA, which is I talk about that in the book too. But these localized therapies are really, really effective. They're safe, and they're actually safe for everybody. So even people who couldn't use systemic estrogen therapy, like you've had a heart attack, you've had a stroke, you've had blood clots, you have an estrogen dependent cancer. Most of those people actually can safely use vaginal hormones because they're not being absorbed into the whole body. And they're really, really, really effective. But there's also hyaluronic acid, which can be great locally. There are device treatments that can be done that can help remodel that tissue. I think people might have heard of some of the, like, you know, Mona Lisa, which is not my favorite, but it's okay. I actually like the radio frequency devices better, but these are all basically energy-based devices. They came from aesthetics, right? So,
oh, right. People, yes, right? Yes.
And they've been literally retooled to use in the vaginal area, and they basically cause a micro injury, and then the body's response is to heal and bring some of those, the blood flow back, the oxygen, the nutrients, the collagen, the elastin. So yeah, I mean, it's never, again, never one size fits all, and everything isn't going to work for everybody, but these are all options that are available for people.
Okay. Two questions. The first is, if you are taking systemic estrogen, should that answer the vaginal issues that may arise? And with that, can you then also use vaginal estrogen, or is that overloading?
No, you definitely can, because again, so most people, depending on what the dose of their systemic estrogen is and how it's being administered through the mouth, through the skin, most people, it's really not going to be enough, and they are going to need the addition of the vaginal estrogen. And the answer to that is yes, it is safe, because as I mentioned, you're not getting systemic absorption. In other words, you're putting it in the vaginal canal and it's getting to the blood flow in that area, but it's not circulating throughout your body. So it's not only having a positive impact on the rest of your body, it's not having a negative impact on the rest of your body. I mean, I'm being broad here, because there's actually one ring product vaginally, which is actually meant for systemic use, but generally speaking, they're different. And everybody's different, you know, this is the other thing too. People's needs are going to change. I think something that people need to understand is it's not going to be a one and done. You're not going to go meet with your doctor, have the conversation, and now you're done. Like, this is going to be a continually evolving experience, just like your life is. So it's not a disease that's going to be cured. It's a condition of being alive that's going to evolve, and your needs are going to evolve. Your desires are going to evolve. Therapies that are available are going to evolve. Our thinking about them is going to evolve, and you have to just kind of be aware of that. And that's why it's so important to understand the basics. That's why I wrote the book. People don't understand the definitions, and they don't understand that they get to advocate for themselves or how to advocate for themselves. And I think that is a really important point of this conversation of what you do in your community, giving people information, giving them the tools, giving them permission, not to feel like it has to be a fight or an argument, but that this is an opportunity to now learn about yourself, own yourself, and again, take some agency back and optimize things. Like the optimization shouldn't be only coming from outside. It has to come from you.
Right. Thank you. I love that. That is enlightening, truly. It really is. Okay. Weight gain. Now, yeah. Before I let you take the floor, in your book, you share, you suggest mantras, the use of mantras, and what you specifically suggested or offered about weight gain was combating negative self-talk about food. And I know this is a little bit blurry. It's sort of asking you to address two different things, but I think they're just that important. And if you could kind of dive into that a little bit, maybe why the weight gain happens, why it becomes so difficult to address. And then beyond that, this idea of being worthy to honor our cravings, worthy to eat and enjoy delicious food. I thought these were just really significant things to hang on to.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's really, there's two, this in and of itself could be a whole book.
I know.
Right, which is fine. And other people are writing books about that. So that's great, because I'm happy to support that. But having a female body in this culture is just a minefield, right? Because we are expected to be a certain way and we know how to do this and do that, but all this stuff, right? Which is all comes to bear, I think, at all different points in our lives. But I think the whole aging female body is like such a big issue, right? Because, if we don't love ourselves, really the messaging is nobody else will. Mm-hmm. In fact, this is not what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to cryopreserve ourselves, which is just insane. So, and it's also not doable. So I think that's where the negative self-talk idea comes from. There's also a whole, community and world out there in nutritional science and in nutritional counseling that is looking at sort of anti-diet culture. In other words, like this whole idea of like returning to food as nourishment and as a joy and ritual and fun, because I mean, food is fuel, but also it is culturally significant. It's fun. It tastes good. And I think if we remove all of that and make it all about what I put in my mouth is going to come out in my body and what's the outcome, that's just that's survival mode. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this also really an expression of disordered eating and body dysmorphia and stuff that I really felt very strongly that I wanted to not only steer clear of, I didn't want to encourage that, but I wanted to encourage people to love themselves. If I'm saying to myself and to all of you, hey, we're aging and that is amazing and I want us to love that, then that includes how our body might change. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of this is that there are obviously diseases associated with aging and weight gain that I would like people to be aware of so that they can be honest with themselves about how they are handling that and moving forward. And there are health consequences to both over dieting and yo-yoing, and there's health consequences to being having medical issues related to not good eating. I don't know how else to put that, right? Because it's not just obesity. I don't like that word. And it's really triggering for a lot of people. And I talk about it in the book. The whole body mass index thing is kind of like, we use it in science, but it's just bullshit. It's not really accurate. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, I'd rather people understand what their heart health is and metabolic stuff. What's your blood sugar? What's your lipid profile? The deep dive on your cholesterol. The fat that you're getting, we all know where we're getting it. I don't need to you don't need to see, exactly where. Okay. But is that subcutaneous, under the skin, which is, I don't like it, but not necessarily that dangerous. Or is it visceral fat inside around the organs? That's unhealthy. You can love yourself, but that's not healthy. I'm not going to tell you that's healthy because it's not, it's bad for you. Mm-hmm. It's inflammatory. It's going to increase your risk for cancer, diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's, all this other stuff. So if you really want to be serious about your weight from a health perspective, make sure your heart is being addressed women's heart disease is a huge issue that is just under-recognized. I feel like people are starting to talk about it now. I mean, we've all been talking about it forever, but I feel like the public is starting to get it. And they're starting to demand. Look, I myself as a physician had to advocate for myself with my previous doctor. Like, hey, don't you think you should do a calcium carotid scan on me? I had gestational diabetes and everybody in my family has heart disease. You know, like, and he was like, oh yeah, we should do that. Why did I have to ask?
My brother,
who's younger than me, had already had every kind of heart thing done. Because dudes get that shit done. And we don't.
Right.
So that's my big picture of the weight. Look, are there ways to get back into better shape? Yes, there are. Yes, there definitely are. I mean, I'm not the guru on this, but I know plenty. Portion size, it's really important. You know, as we get older, we don't build muscle as easily. We don't need as much fuel. I mean, if you are a competitive athlete, you need to eat a lot. If you're not, you know, you don't need to eat that much. If you want to eat it and you're healthy and you're fine with it, go at it. But if you don't, you can't, it's lifestyle. It's not, right. It's not like, oh, that party's coming. I'm going to just not eat for 3 weeks and I'm going to fit in the dress. I know I did that. It doesn't work anymore. Over-exercising stresses your body. Cardio, great for your heart, not fat burning. Sorry. Peloton, not losing weight. You've got to do resistance training. You have to lift weights. It's really important for your brain, for your bones, building muscle, and burning more efficiently. I've gotten called out for saying that, but whatever, because it's true. Not eating late at night, having a, I hate using the terms, but you know, intermittent fasting really does work for a lot of people. There's a lot of really interesting data now emerging, which, you know, I learned a lot because I had gestational diabetes. So I kind of had to learn how to eat differently during my first pregnancy.
Right.
And food combining is really powerful. So having a protein or fat with your carb, now it looks like the order in which you eat food, you know, eating those veggies, those green veggies, then eating the protein, the fat, then the carb, that tends to diminish that glucose spike. And so you're not storing as fat as much. Here's the thing. If doing these things is overwhelming to you and it's taking the joy out of your food experience, really consider not doing that. And just, again, focus on health, moving your body in some way every day. You know, maybe you have to try some new jeans. That's the biggest tragedy in your life. You're probably doing very well. And, you know, really. And you know, learning to accept some of the things that are going to change.
Thank you for that. Thank you very much. I have a lot more to say about that, but hopefully we'll get to speak again and we can get more into that.
Yeah.
I hair, skin, nails, and teeth. This was a thing for me. I knew my hair might start shedding. It has. I knew my skin would change. I didn't know about the nails. I didn't know about tooth pain and like all that happens with our gums and all. I didn't know to expect that. And you mentioned it. And I think it's worth mentioning.
It doesn't happen to everybody, but tell me about your nails. Cause did I write something about that? Cause I don't remember that.
Yeah, no, you do. Hair, skin, nails, and teeth. It may have been on your website. I did a fair amount of research, but you do mention or you highlight it, that it's something that can change as well.
I mean, most of it is estrogen decreases, blood flow changes, elastin, collagen. I mean, that's a lot of what it is. Hair is a little more complicated because it has to do with sort of the shifting ratios of estrogens and androgens, testosterone, because early in our transition, you know, women make more testosterone than estrogen in our younger years. And I think people don't really realize that. We don't make as much as men, but we make more than estrogen. And so as the estrogen is declining, the testosterone is too, but they're declining at different rates. And so you actually have like an overabundance of testosterone. I'm again, like generalizing here. That's why people start to get acne and stuff, little hair growth that we don't like, what we call rogue hairs, and hair loss on your head. So that sucks. But, you know, hormone therapy can help with some of it, not always. You know, the whole collagen.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. What's your take on that?
It's great for your gut. It's actually really good for your gut. I don't think there's any data to support that it's really having a significant impact on your skin or your hair or nails. I will leave that to my colleagues in dermatology, but trust me, I have about 40 bags of collagen. People like to set. Because they send me stuff. People send me things, which I'm appreciative. And I'm like, cool, I'm going to put it in my coffee. I have no idea what the hell is doing.
But you know, you're making me think that if it does it stand to reason that if it's good for the gut, that it's good for, you know, the fallout goes far and it may be good for everything else. That.
If your gut isn't good, and here's the thing with everything, you know, with your weight, with your mood, with your sleep, with everything that we're talking about. And you know, what's so interesting. I'm going to go back to Ayurveda. In Ayurveda, when we do a consultation, the way I was taught was no matter what you come to me with, where you're coming to me for general health or a medical issue, we always created a formula unique for you, an herbal formula, and always, no matter what, address the mind and the gut, always. You're coming to me with a skin condition. You're coming to me with diabetes. You're coming to me with depression. You're coming to me with your toe hurts. You're getting a formula for your mind and a formula for your gut. So you tell me who's fucking brilliant. Okay.
Well, yes. Yeah, see, right? This is what I'm saying. Yes. I feel like to divorce the two is a big mistake.
Well, it's also like this came down from the rishis. Okay. The sages supposedly, I'm not kidding. The lore is that the sages came from the mountain, said, hey, this is what you got to do. And they were like, okay, let's write the book.
Okay. Let's do it. It matters. And, right. And it's so only it
turns
now.
Turns out they're right. The microbiome is literally everything. So collagen maybe calming our gut is helping us, you know, absorb nutrients better, you know, creating the proper barrier to protect us from acidic foods, from spicy things, helping us with our serotonin and our other neurotransmitters that are like largely based in the gut. So on and on and on and on. It's so, I actually, interviewed Emron Mayer, who's one of the preeminent microbiome researchers in the world at UCLA. He just got like a big $20 million, you know, thing. And I interviewed him for the book. And I was like, I know the gut has to have an impact on hormones. What is it? And he's like, I agree. And I don't know. We don't know. I was like,
yeah. 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 Womp womp. But yeah. Yes, I mean, it'll come, right? That information
will come. Yeah. So, I mean, I got off topic with hair and nails, but
No.
I don't think collagen is going to hurt you. I just can't promise you that it's going to give you a shining head of hair.
That's fine. We're running out of time and there's so much. This is such a rich and helpful conversation. I want to get into feelings a bit, which you talk about at length. Yes. Ageism, social connection. You talk about, you have a chapter, a piece called Be a Good Teammate. Mm-hmm. Could you expand on that a bit? And you know, here's the thing that I was struck by is you say there, you know, like therapy, for example, a therapist can only do so much. You're only spending, let's call it an hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, with them out of a week. And the rest, as you said earlier, is really up to you. It's up to you to sort of embrace your own agency. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you could get into that a little bit and also just sort of spend a moment talking about social connection.
So important. So I want to say this. When I first started doing the boot camps, because they were in real life things, I thought I'm addressing a need in the community because I'm seeing patients all the time and they have a million questions. I can't answer them all. I'm seeing people kind of getting misinformation. I want to create an experience where people can learn. And that happened. But really what people were leaving with was community. Mm. And I don't know why I didn't anticipate that. Maybe because there's just something innate about a woman creating a community and a circle. There's just something like that we do, that we share, we want to be around each other. But that was really the powerful lesson for me starting menopause boot camps. And it just brought me back to like, well, of course, every time in my life where things are happening and need to be worked out or processed, or you need support, there's a change, it's scary. There's a lot of grief involved in menopausal transition, a lot of grief. You know, like I always have to talk to my team when we're creating content because they're like, want to go with the joy of the journey. And I'm like, you guys, you know, it can't be.
It
also freaking sucks sometimes. Yeah. Like, you know, you're 35, wait, you'll see. Mm-hmm. So I have to kind of remind them, like, can we please validate that some of this really is sucky? But, you know, when you're going through a hard time, you have a choice to isolate or to reach out and get help. And it's really, there's a time to go inward and to figure out who you are and what your needs are. And there's a time to ask for help. And I think as women, that's a natural thing to do. And I saw it happen in those boot camps, and it's happened for me over the course of my life. And for sure, right now, what's happening in menopause right now, how you and I even met, you know, like, mm-hmm. and like online, the online, sorry, my hair, this is so crazy, but whatever. No. It's only you guys, you don't care. We you can see what it looks like underneath.
We're just
right
happy
now.
You're
I
here.
I mean, tomorrow I'm going to be doing another event where I met you in person for the first mm-hmm. time, the Swell and mm-hmm. Stripes are doing a big event in LA. It's so much fun to be around my people. Mm-hmm. It's not just like that we're sharing and we're creating this opportunity. Like I'm excited to see my friends,
right?
Like normal humans.
Right.
So being a good teammate is also understanding and anticipating what the other people around you might need. You know, in medicine, we say see one, do one, teach one, you know? So you see something, how something is done, you do it. Now you teach somebody else, you know, paying it forward, whatever it is, that communal ethos of caring for each other and caring for ourselves, and also reaching out, asking for help, receiving. You know, it's really important to receive. A lot of what I see in this community is a lot of really hyper competent achievers like me and you, and we have to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves and we're asking for help and attention too, because part of our journey, or I'm going to speak for myself, part of my journey as a healer is to make sure that I'm also getting healed and that I'm working on myself. And so if I have all this wisdom and knowledge of 57 years to share with the people, and I don't mean just us, but even people who are younger, older, I have to also take care of me and make sure that I'm getting taken care of as well. That's part of my journey. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. I think I'm all over the place as usual, but mm-hmm. that's what all of that means to me. And the boot camps have been this incredible experience of people opening up, sharing, not feeling alone, not being ashamed, saying the word out loud, really feeling like relieved, powerful, excited, knowing that they have a place to go where they can get not only information, but support and help and love. And the next thing that's happening is, you know, I just shot my certification program. So there's
I was going to ask you about that.
So it's going to be available because I always conceived of this as something that was a gift to the world, right? Like I'm not thinking I'm going to go do a boot camp all over. First of all, I don't have the energy or the time. And second of all, how am I going into your community? I don't know exactly what your community needs. I don't know what your standards are, what your rituals are, what your cultural touch points are. It's arrogant for me, especially as a white person, to come in like so. And it's so cool, Rachel, because I've had people from online since the book came out. Hey, how can we do this? And I'm telling them, actually,
yeah, it's coming. So in other words, so we will be able to become certified mm-hmm. in the menopause boot camp program then bring it to our own communities. That was my goal. Oh, that's so exciting. And that's going to be later this year. Yeah,
probably not even that long. I mean, we did the videos, they have to get edited. We're working on the workbook. It's really high value, you know. It's going to give you like all the tools you need, include everything from leadership and how to run a group to content. You know, the book is the template, but there's content that I've created specifically for it. There's a workout and then the workbook to do it. And then it'll be out, realistically sometime in the later spring, I think.
This is fantastic. So, yeah, I can't
really
wait.
I'm
going to be looking out for it. Okay. A couple of community member questions that I wanted to get to in our last 10 minutes. Yeah. Okay, a 50-year-old reached out to say that she believes she's been perimenopausal for 6 months to a year. She's suffering with heavy depression, anxiety that comes and goes, typically when her cycle is coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big things we didn't talk about because we can't talk about everything. That is really classic anxiety, depression, and panic out of the blue. And that's exactly what I usually see with my patients is it's that second half of the cycle. So that blue mood can be really intense and very disruptive. So first of all, let me just say that antidepressants can be helpful. I think what happens in this time of life is a lot of women get diagnosed with mood disorders and get antidepressants without understanding that actually the root cause of it is perimenopause. That's not to say that Lexapro isn't amazing for people, but I think understanding where it's coming from would be better. So I do see that progesterone, replacing some progesterone, actually with progesterone, oral micronized progesterone in the second half of the cycle can absolutely help a lot of people. There are a couple of botanicals, in particular like chasteberry, which basically is doing that in your own body. But remember, herbs, 60 to 90 days of consistent use, right? So you'd have to, I think you really, this is where you really need to work with a practitioner, to be perfectly honest. Acupuncture, Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, very, very supportive. And sometimes just mindfulness. Sometimes people come in and they tell me this and I say, hey, track your cycles and let's see what's going on. And they're like, oh, wow, you know what? I just know when that hits, I actually am not trying to quit my job or, you know, kick my kid out of the house. I'm actually going to get a cycle. I'm going to bleed. When I need to get in the cave and take care of myself. Sometimes that's all people need to do. It just needs to be validated. So you'll have to see where you fall. I hope that you get
I
help.
I think too, I do too. I you mentioned this earlier, but I think talk therapy too can be so helpful around this, right? Because I, like you just said, there are these stressors in life that come up and maybe they feel louder when you're closer to a cycle. Yeah. Right. Yes. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's
but
something.
It requires a therapist who's knowledgeable about this, because I think otherwise what happens is people do get, they don't get the right information,
Another question, why are my periods getting closer and closer and not farther apart?
Well, that's kind of the first part. So for most, most people, their cycles will get closer and heavier. And again, this has to do with, ovarian aging and ovulation changes. Okay. Because mid cycle is when you release that egg. And then when you don't get pregnant, it's when you bleed. But the second half of the cycle, your ovary is making progesterone in order to help get ready for a gestation. And when that doesn't happen, you don't get pregnant. But as the ovary gets older, it's not only making less estrogen, it's making less progesterone. So that's one of the reasons why you get some of these gnarly symptoms, and also sometimes why your cycle will start getting closer together. Then eventually you start to skip more and they get lighter and then they go away. Everybody does not have the same pattern, but that's fairly common. So if you're bleeding really, really heavily and it's disruptive, that is, you should see your doctor, because you want to make sure there's not polyps or fibroid or overgrowth of the lining of your uterus or something that requires medical attention.
Okay. Bone, muscles, joints.
I mean, in the last 4 minutes.
In the last 4 minutes. Tell us everything
you can. We talked a little bit about it. We do, we require a lot more work to maintain our bones and our muscles. Estrogen receptors are all over our body. It's not just estrogen loss. It's also aging. Men have the same thing. So that is why staying active and in particular putting pressure on your joints in order to increase that resistance, which will help the bone respond by stabilizing and the muscle to build. Very, very important. Very important to stay strong, to stay flexible, because what you want to do is you want to prevent the fall, right? So core strength and stability, flexibility, really, really important to prevent issues. Joints, on the other hand, your joints are suffering and we see a lot of joint issues. Again, wear and tear, this is just aging human beings, right? If you were an athlete or you've had an accident, that stands to reason. But there's definitely something that happens as estrogen declines or as estrogen fluctuates, like very erratically. And you see frozen shoulder, joint pain, stiffness. Yes. It's definitely related to loss of estrogen. It's not really well understood, but Kelly Casperson just posted something, I think on maybe on frozen shoulder and estrogen. But because the thing is, it's not like, I don't know that we know that estrogen therapy or hormone therapy would fix that, but it might stabilize it. It's definitely related to hormone fluctuations. That pain is not in your head. It's real.
Right.
I do see a lot of people feel better on hormones, by the way.
Yeah. Dr. Suzanne, I would say, you know, your book is kind of like a little bit of a love letter to people out there, aging and perimenopausal and menopausal. And I really do encourage everyone to get it. It highlights anything and everything related to this experience and this particular season of life. But, you know, finally, if there's sort of any last words you would offer those of us here today, what might you want to say?
Spread the word, because I think the more we talk about this, the more we feel okay about where we are and we share it with other people, the more we're going to shift culture. I mean, I want people like you and your audience and your community to know how powerful you are, because people are listening. People were not talking about this very much when I started writing the book, when I started doing this work. And it's crazy to me. I mean, yeah, you and I are in a little bit of an echo chamber, but it's really all over the place now and people are taking notice. And so Everybody doesn't have to be the voice of the movement. And there isn't, the thing that I think we are seeing is there isn't going to be a voice. It's going to be a chorus. Yeah. So the fact that you even showed up, you know, give yourself some credit. And if you just discuss it with one other person so that they know, like, oh, this is the person I can ask things about or talk about or vent with. Like that to me, I really want people to, I don't know, I landed on the planet this time around to help people. And I feel like, you know, if this is my contribution, then I'm super gratified by that, you know?
Well,
and
we're
so appreciative of you.
Oh, thank you. I am entirely grateful that you carved out this hour. I just want to say this one thing, because I think it's important to mention also just about what you said. It's reminding me also to sort of share what we're going through, share our stories and experiences intergenerationally, yeah. Also, right? Not huge. Just with each other. I think that's so important. I think all the mm-hmm. time of younger women and older women who I know who are having the conversation with me or through me or with each other around me, because I start talking about it and yeah. you start talking about it and she started yeah. talking about it and all of yeah. that. So I, and to the men in our lives as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
It should go that way. Dr. Suzanne, thank you so much for this hour and this time. I'd love to talk again, maybe when your boot camp certification yeah, program yeah. is up and running. I'd love to anytime. Extend that to people. That would be great. That'd have be fun awesome. Tomorrow at the event. And thank yeah, you thanks. All for coming. Thanks, Rixi.
Thank this you everybody been great. For being
thank
here.
You so much.
Thanks,
bye
Rachel,
everyone.
Bye.
Be well. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to our Perimenopause What the F podcast. The perimenopause journey can be lonely, and it doesn't have to be that way. Make sure to download our free Peri app to connect with perimenopause warriors in the same stage of life. See you next time, Peri sisters.